1039 1450 WKXL NHTalkRadio.com. We welcome you to another edition of Feldis and Kale. We are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire farmers, Ken Kale, Dan Feldis. Dan, since last I saw you, you went on the injury list here at WKXL.
Yeah, it's not a radio-related injury.
No, it's not.
I didn't get hit in the head with a microphone or something. But I did attempt, you know, at age 42, Ken, I'm not what I used to be. I was working out and tore my shoulder. So I have a torn shoulder muscle and got my arm in a sling. Might need surgery. We'll find out this week. Get an MRI this week.
But Dan on the IL here at KXL. And someone who is not is our guest for this segment of Feldis and Kale, and it's Neil Levesque, the executive director of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College, who has had the courage to be with us now for a third time, I do believe, Feldis and Kale, and he may be the only one in that category.
Third Neil, time's a charm.
It is. Welcome back.
Well, thanks. Thanks. Great to be on. I love this show, and I think we dig deeper into politics more than just the regular top lines that you hear every day, and I think it's great for people, and looking forward to today's show.
All right, we got that. That will be used in our next promo for Feldis and Kale, right there. The words of Neil Levesque, who was on our first promo, by the way. So now when we update the promo, we'll just take that line that Neil just uttered, because we appreciate that. And that's what we try to do, is dig a little bit deeper than just what you see in the headlines or, you know, a 2 or 3 minute interview that you hear other places. We get behind the story behind the story here.
Behind
the
story.
On Feldis and Kale. But
it goes that deep. But we did not pay Neil to say that.
No, we didn't. No, we didn't. And he said it very well, despite the fact that he was not compensated for those remarks. Neil, whenever we chat with you, I always think of a couple of things right off the top of my head, and one of them is, you know, your love of the ocean and fishing and lobstering, and so give us an update. People want to hear what you've been doing out on the high seas.
Well, we had pretty good tuna season so far this year. A lot of tuna were caught, and then they shut the season down. They have a very strict regulations as far as what can be caught and how many metric tons can be caught, and so they shut it down until September 1st. So we're kind of in this little hiatus as far as keeping a fish, but if a fish is over 73 inches long, you can keep it and sell it. You have to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's under that, you can keep one, but, you know, that's like a 200-and-something pound fish, and, you know, bluefin tuna is great as sushi, but you know, it doesn't really freeze well. It's not really great, I don't think so, anyway, for cooking. So we went out on a maiden voyage, and, you know, you can go and sit out there for 8 hours, and nothing happens. That's actually more common than catching a fish. And so, you know, these shows on National Geographic where they're constantly having the reels, you know, going off and everything are kind of rare. But we ended up fighting 7 giant bluefin tuna, landing 5, releasing all 5. They were all about 70 inches before noon one day. So that was a highlight. And then one day I was out alone, and I hooked into what I thought was a tuna, and I was fighting it. And then finally when it appeared, it was about, I estimate, about 16 feet long. It was a thresher shark. They have those long tails, so, you know, from the fork in the tail, it's probably only 10 feet long or 8 feet long, but with the long tail, it adds a whole bunch more. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I said...
And you cut the line.
It's a draw. So I didn't mess with him after that, but there are a lot of sharks out there, and it's sort of interesting when you're reeling something up and you know, you sort of see like a haddock coming, you know, making its way about 10 feet down and making its way to the boat, and all of a sudden there's a flash and the haddock disappears, and that's usually poor beagle sharks come up and basically steal what would otherwise be a pretty good fish and chips dinner.
Yeah, there you go. So you have to. It has to be 73 inches long in order for you to keep it, correct?
That's correct. And yeah. So that's the commercial aspect of this. And you have to sell it at 73 inches. What they do is that they come into the Gulf of Maine, and so an 80-inch fish would be, let's say, 300 pounds. And they start eating all the fat fish, like herring, and they fatten up. So the same fish will be 80 inches by the end of the summer, but it weighs 400 pounds.
Yeah.
So I know that, well, Dan just mentioned that he's 42, but I'm 51, so those of us who are listening to this who are 51 completely understand the life cycle and the fattening of a giant bluefin tuna, because maybe it's happened to some of us, like me.
And theoretically, I'm old enough to be both of your fathers, but, in theory anyway. So I know the aging process well, and the fattening process too. So at any rate, how, 73 inches, most people aren't 73 inches. Most people are not 73 inches. They're less. So how do you determine, Neil, when you've got something on the line that it is 73 inches or more? How do you determine that?
It's actually very hard. So, if you can eyeball them and you sort of have an idea. I mean, when there's a 90-inch fish that comes up beside your boat, you know the difference.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've seen that. We've fought two fish so far. For over 6 hours, we fought them. One fish we fought for 6.5 hours, and we lost it. That's right. But when you have one that's sort of on the line, or you're kind of questioned, first thing you do is you don't harpoon it like you might see on some of these television shows. You try to bring it up to the boat, and you try to measure it. And if it's not 73 inches, what you do is you do your best to swim the fish, because the fish needs to sort of recover, and they'll start really moving around once they're recovered, and then you try to get the hook out, which is another. My brother is a dentist, and so that's his job, to get the hook out. They have no idea that they're being operated on by a Harvard Medical School graduate. But
I'm sure they would appreciate it if they
when the big sharks come up to the side of the boat, and I say, "Why don't you try to get the hook out of that thing?"
Yeah.
But we have gotten the hooks out of. My brother's actually pretty talented at doing this, not just in the dental chair, but we've gotten shark hooks out, so that's always fun.
I can imagine it would be 6.5 hour struggle though, and not coming away with the fish. That has to be extremely frustrating.
I've heard swear words out of my brother that I've never heard before.
I can well imagine.
And, it's a long, long day after that, and a long day coming back in. But tuna fishing they're so powerful that there are a lot of people in the world who love to fish, and if they ever experience fighting a giant bluefin tuna, it's so amazing that it's really addicting. There's a lot of people who buy boats after they fight a couple bluefin tuna.
Mm. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. So what is the process, for folks who are listening, fighting a big fish, you let the line out. How do you make the determination about the letting the line out, reel in, pull in? How do you make those judgment calls?
So a lot of it are just listening to a lot of experienced fishermen and sort of getting the hints that they do. And when you hang around Rye Harbor, for example, there's a lot, or Gloucester, there's a lot of people that know what they're doing, and you sort of pick up the hints from it. Mm-hmm. But basically the way it works is that there is usually 4 or 5 rods on a boat, and you're letting out a live mackerel or a live herring, or sometimes a dead herring or a dead mackerel. And it's about 100 feet down. Sometimes it could be much more than that, or sometimes less. And it swims around on a very, very sensitive piece of fluorocarbon, because the fish are very smart. And there's a very small hook, so if you if you can imagine a hook that's basically a little over an inch in a sort of circle, if you will, and it's on the live mackerel swimming around,
mm-hmm.
and the tuna come through, and hopefully they hit it, and when they do, the reel just starts screaming, and usually there's about 28 to 35 pounds of drag on the reel,
mm-hmm.
so it would be hard, Dan, for me to pull that line for more than a few feet, you know.
Yeah.
And when that reel goes off, those tuna fish are hitting it. It's like attaching to a race car, and they'll take 100, 200 yards of line in, you know, a very quick amount of time. It's so dramatic. And so at that point, you're trying to let yourself off the anchor, so you throw the anchor line, so now you're free of the anchor, and you try to bring in the other rods so that you have nothing complicating what's happening,
mm-hmm.
and now you just fight the fish. And sometimes it's a matter of inches. And, you know, if you remember your days of reading The Old Man and the Sea when he's lying against
great
the boat,
book.
Yeah,
and he's saying, die, fish, just let me, you know, kill you. And it's like just a matter of little inches and inches and inches. That's the way it can be. And it's the power of those animals is unbelievable. And then when you get them in and you harpoon them and then you finally ice them down, you get them on the boat and you bring them in, the fish buyer comes. And usually, you know, in a non-COVID situation, they go into basically, it's almost like a big box that's iced down, and they are on the next 747 to Japan.
Wow. It's fascinating. I mean, it really is. For those of us who have certainly never done anything like that, it is very fascinating to hear about. So what do you use for bait, Neil?
So you go out and you catch live mackerel, and they go into a live well, or if you can catch a whiting, which is another word for a hake, or a herring work, I think, the best. So you're matching the hatch. So if you're a fly fisherman and you know you go to a little trout stream and you try to figure out what's hatching that day and you try to match it with your fly, it's very similar with an 800-pound fish where you're trying to match what's out there and what they're eating. And, you know, it's about $25 to $30 for the leader and the hook. So if a shark comes in, so if all of a sudden there's a bunch of sharks and the shark hits the bait, it may sound exciting that you're, you know, fighting a shark, but the truth is that you just lost $30 because the shark will rub against the leader and it's all done. It's mm-hmm. no longer, you can no longer keep them. So, you know, it's a lot of fun, and but there's a lot of time where you're just sitting there for hours and hours and hours, and nothing is happening. So,
other than drinking beer.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because normally there was a guy on Cape Cod who hooked into a great white shark over the weekend, and the title of the story in the Boston Globe is, "Hold my beer, I've got to fight this fish." But the truth be told is that we never have alcohol on the boat, because when you're commercial fishing, the legal limit is 0.04.
Oh, wow.
Which I think is basically one Narragansett if you're a Jaws fan. So you don't screw around. You know, the Coast Guard's out there. We actually got boarded this weekend by the Coast Guard, and they check all your gear and check all your licenses and make sure you're doing everything correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of sort of police effort, if you will, out there. A
lot of regulation out there on the high seas. Neil Levesque is with us, and I promise we will talk a little bit about politics anyway here on Feldis and Kale, 103.9, 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. Great to have you along with us. We'll take a break. Feldis and Kale presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Our guest on this edition of Feldis and Kale at WKXL is Neil Levesque, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. And we are presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And we haven't chatted, Neil, really, since I know you've been on these airwaves, but not on this show. Most recent poll was released by the St. Anselm College Survey Center at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics. The president and our congressional delegation took quite a hit as far as their popularity is concerned in your latest poll.
That's right. So they started to drop, and I think that this is fairly, you know, you could sort of predict that this was probably going to happen when a party is in power, as they are in Washington, D.C. They start enacting things, and they start becoming accountable for things that they're responsible for and things that they're not. And it can be fair or unfair, but they started to slip slightly in the polls. And what we saw is that basically in that poll that COVID dropped to being a top concern of only 13% of respondents. And then things that we haven't really seen in polling as a top concern rose. Government spending, 22%. Illegal immigration, which has always been slightly high there, that's a top concern. Healthcare costs. And people are concerned, 83% of respondents were concerned about inflation. That is really interesting. And so when you have inflation and the national debt, which also scored high as a big concern, and you're the president and the Democrats in Congress, and, you know, joined by some moderate Republicans who are passing some fairly substantial $1 trillion, $3.5 trillion budgets, and the public is concerned about government spending and things like inflation that is the result sometimes of a lot of government spending, it can have an adverse reaction on the party that is in power. And I think that that's what we've seen. We have not polled as recent as sort of some of this uptake in the Delta variant, but I would suspect that that 13% is probably rising and people are more concerned now with COVID again. But at least about midsummer, that number had dropped.
So when is the next poll coming out, Neil?
We will do a poll before Labor Day. We like to see where people are as we go into, this is sort of the dog days of the summer. Right now, obviously, the Senate is hard at work on this budget and this infrastructure package. But after that, they will go into what they call a district work period, what other people call their August vacation. Depends on who you're asking. When all of the congressional staffers wave goodbye to their members who go back to their districts, and there's a big sigh of relief on Capitol Hill because you can sort of take a breath. But that happens in August, and likely to see sort of things quiet down a little bit. One thing that we've seen with the Biden administration is, you know, he went 60 days without having a press conference. It's much, I think we could all agree, if we can agree on anything in politics, we could agree that the Biden administration is sort of much quieter than the Trump administration was as far as being in the news every day. And so I suspect as we go through August that will be consistent.
Neil, in addition to polling on favorabilities and all this other stuff and potential U.S. Senate and potential governor matchups, all this other stuff, what do you see, just in terms of your expert opinion, are the major issues that are going to be taken up in Washington, D.C.? I mean, obviously, we've heard a lot about the bipartisan infrastructure package. But beyond that, there's a lot of proposals out there, the so-called For the People Act, voting rights, you got paid family leave, a national plan, you got national initiatives on child care and the American Families Plan. It looks like the bipartisan infrastructure package is going to go through at least the Senate. So I got two questions. Number one is, what's the prospects for that in the House, the U.S. House? On the bipartisan infrastructure package, which in all likelihood passes today, Tuesday the 10th, in the U.S. Senate. That's number one. And number two, what are the other issues you think that might pass? Because there's a lot of stuff out there.
So there's two things that you mentioned, the infrastructure package, which I think, you know, the House is a much bigger body, and there's a lot of wild cards, to say the least. But I think that Pelosi will hold her own, and I think that they will have the votes for this infrastructure package. I think that they're probably going to run on a lot of that going into the 2022 election. I think that that's crucial for them. In the budget package, which is a $3.5 trillion package, there's less certainty as to whether or not the 50 members of the People Who Caucus with the Democrats, so that includes people like Bernie Sanders, will hold. And if one or two don't like the budget, that'll screw that up to some degree. But there'll be a lot of sort of human, social service type spending in that package, including things like child care, universal pre-K, things like that that'll be in that package. I think that those are things, again, that I think the Democrats will run on next year. But it's interesting because there's a lot of top-line issues that are sort of circulating, I think, amongst the population. Let's just take, again, illegal immigration. It rates very high, even in New Hampshire, where we see less of it than places such as Texas. It is a high number with voters and is a big concern amongst voters. And so there are some top-line sort of news stories that I think are sticking out that I think it's going to be hard for Democrats to sort of maneuver around. You mentioned the voting rights bill, I believe it's H1.
Yeah, H1.
Yep. Which I believe has already failed or is destined to fail. But we have some moderates like Senator Amy Klobuchar, who's really sort of trying to bring together members of the Senate on some compromise or on a compromise piece of legislation that I think actually would probably have a good chance of passing. It's less inflammatory to the Republicans and most likely will have sort of this Manchin, Senator Manchin's blessing. I think that that's more likely, and it'll be interesting. Now, let me tell you some dynamics here, I think that this is interesting. President Biden and his administration have assigned Vice President Harris with some tasks within the administration, one of which is dealing with the border, and the second one is dealing with this voting legislation. Both are not necessarily being successful. They're not winning the hearts of Americans right now. So she's almost been given sort of these, mentioning the voting again, almost like taking an anchor for some of this legislation that she has to be in charge of, or some of these issues. They're not exactly win-wins for her. And it's been interesting to see that she was given these by this administration. Now you have Senator Amy Klobuchar, who ran for president in the last cycle, did fairly well, has a high profile, and she could be the champion of this next voting bill. So I think there's a lot of interesting dynamics here. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but you know, remember that even though they're Democrats, or in, you know, you could say the same with Republicans, there's always a lot of competition within these, as you know, Dan, within these legislative bodies for who shines and who doesn't and who gets credit for things, even amongst people of their own party. And, you know, I'm sure you've experienced this many, many times. I was a recent college graduate many years ago, and I walked into the New Hampshire State House, and the Republicans, to which I was a member of, controlled the governor's office, the executive council, the state senate, the state representatives, everything, right down the thing. Poor Ray Buckley. I thought, this is going to be great. We can do all kinds of things. But what I found out is that in those situations, they all fight amongst themselves just as much as they would normally in more of a two-party system. So I think maybe some of that's going on down there.
Interesting.
So you're saying that ultimately Amy Klobuchar could be looked upon in a more favorable light than Vice President Harris among Democrats?
That's what I'm saying, is that, you know, here you have somebody who was picked to be vice president, but maybe it's Klobuchar who starts winning battles in the Senate and sort of becoming a champion for successful legislation that gets passed. She has a record, and I can't remember what the number is, but she has, like, the record for the most bipartisan pieces of legislation in the last Senate, I believe. And she figures out how to get things done. She's less vocal than, say, some members of the House or Senate who, you know, their Twitter accounts are the thing that's most important to them. But she certainly could shine if some sort of voting rights legislation passes that she's written.
Do you think, there are any thoughts that that's, planning ahead for 2024?
Well, there's a funny thing that Lyndon Johnson said, what's the definition of a member of the House of Representatives? And he said somebody who wants to be president. He also said it, he said it, what's the difference between the House and the Senate to George Herbert Walker Bush? He said the difference is chicken salad and chicken S.
Beep.
Yes.
Yep.
Beep. So, but I think the definition of a member of the U.S. Senate is somebody who wants to be president. And remember, you know, President Biden is no spring chicken, and he has said he intends to run for re-election. But that may change. And I think that there's no insider information amongst members of the Senate, but I think that they probably are all sitting there saying, if that changes, what's going to happen here? I have a theory, which isn't a conspiracy theory, as conspiracy theories go, but former President Trump has said that he is going to run in 2024, or intends to. And if he holds to that, he almost blocks the field for a lot of these candidates that sort of like to look in the mirror and say, I look like Donald Trump. So you get like a DeSantis, for example,
right?
Who he can't really do too much. He can't get ahead of President Trump's skis too much and be running into Nashua, New Hampshire to campaign. And I think because you're always sort of thinking, well, if Trump doesn't run, I'll hopefully get his endorsement or the love of his supporters. So he's got to be very careful. And what you could see is that if the scenario that I just mentioned transpires for some reason on the Democratic side, the Democratic primary could be more active than the Republican.
Think about that. Well, Neil Levesque is with us from the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College, Feldes and Kale, right here at 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. We'll take a quick break and be back with more Neil Levesque right after these words on WKXL. Welcome back, 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, Feldes and Kale, presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Neil Levesque with us from the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. He is their executive director, and we were talking a little bit about prospects for the 2024 presidential primary in our last segment. I know you said there's a possibility, anyway, that the Democratic primary may be more active than the Republican, which would be kind of a surprise at this juncture, but it's certainly a possibility. I know some Republicans, Neil, have already been in the state, like Tom Cotton, the Arkansas senator, for example. He's been here.
That's right. I met with him about 2 weeks ago, and he's definitely very active. I think he's less likely to be looking for sort of a Trump endorsement, so I think that he can sort of get out in front a little bit more. But again, I think some of these candidates, you know, Trump sort of blocks the field a little bit,
yeah.
Not only with the activists, but with his own endorsement. And his endorsement in a Republican primary where there's a lot of different candidates could make a big difference. We saw that with this Ohio race the other day where, it was a large field, but the endorsed candidate, President Trump, won. And so if they hold out, sort of wait for him, almost respecting his place to, excuse me, to run again, it may sort of cripple them a little bit in fundraising, getting activists.
Yeah.
Getting a national profile.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, on the flip side, if you see what happened down with a member of the Bush family running for AG primary in Texas, all of the effort, which I thought was, in my view, pretty embarrassing given what Trump said about Jeb Bush and the Bush family and all the disrespectful things that he said, but, all this kind of like placating Trump and all this other thing, and then Trump turns around and endorses his opponent. So it's no guarantee, even if you play that game, it appears, which is, I think, a kind of a silly game, but if you play it and you're a Republican, there's no guarantee that Trump even comes through for you.
And that's a really valid point. And so here, for example, in the first congressional district, we have Congressman Pappas, and he's being opposed by a whole group already of Republicans, it seems. One worked for President Trump, Carolyn Leavitt, in the White House, in the press office. Another was endorsed by Trump, Matt Maurer, last time. Has hired Trump's former campaign manager, or at least is part of his team, Corey Lewandowski. So there's Trump threads weaved into all these campaigns, and there's several other candidates as well. And I think to some degree, you have a primary going on a year plus out from whenever somebody could vote. It's over a year away. And yet, some of this is going to be the fight for the endorsement of from Mar-a-Lago. So who Trump endorses could make a big difference in a race, even here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, you talk about that District 1 race with the incumbent Chris Pappas. And Caroline Leavitt, I understand she is a graduate of St. Anselm College, went to the NHIOP.
Yes. I know her well. She was my student, and she announced her candidacy, I think, 3 weeks ago, and she's been running strong, very much be a similar campaign to what Donald Trump would run, similar messaging. She worked in the TV world for a while. She's from Plastow, New Hampshire, so she knows the state. And then Matt Maurer, who made this announcement last week that he is going to run again, and he's going to make an announcement, I believe, in September. So you've got a fair number of candidates there. There's another one, Representative Baxter, who's on the front page of the Union Leader today. So you've got, it's interesting, these campaigns, they don't, it's not just you. You got to put gasoline in the car. You got to pay staffers and campaign managers and everything else, as you know, Dan, and
yep.
They burn fuel. And so
it's
if you're
more expensive every day.
Exactly. And the old days you could run for Congress on a shoestring, and I think nowadays, when you're making an announcement a year, let's say 14 months before the first ballots are even cast, that's a lot of it's going to take a lot of resources to get all the way to September.
As you mentioned, Dan, Caroline Leavitt worked as an assistant press secretary at the White House for a while in the Trump administration. And, you know, Matt Maurer's got the endorsement last time around and has Corey Lewandowski on his side. You'd have to think the Trump nod in this case would go to Matt Maurer.
Well, I wouldn't make any predictions on that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I think he's completely unpredictable.
Dan is exactly right. And Dan's example of the Texas AG race is a perfect one where, you know, you can presume that you're saying all the right things and you know somebody, but you can't presume with Donald Trump. I think to some degree Donald Trump's sort of a person, you know, the last person that whispered in his ear is the advisor. So, and you know what? The man was elected president, and he, you know, anybody can get elected president without being elected to any other office. Certainly has some pretty good instincts, and so I think he trusts some of those instincts.
So, how important is the Trump endorsement, let's say, specifically in this case, in District 1 in New Hampshire?
I think it's going to be very important. Remember, we're talking about a primary where, you know, very few people now register, well, not very few, but very few people are registered as Republicans compared to undeclareds. You're talking about sort of the people who are the dyed-in-the-wool Republicans are going to vote in a September primary. And so those people are more likely to be much more partisan and potentially more in line with President Trump. And the other thing about Congress nowadays is a lot of people don't know who's running and they don't know all the issues. But if they see an endorsement from someone that they like, and President Trump is certainly a known figure, I think it would make a difference. And I think that so in the meantime, I think that these candidates need to go around and sort of get as much the folks around them as they can. Carolyn Leavitt just got some of the major Trump figures in the state on her side. Al Baldassaro, for one, a major Trump figure here in New Hampshire. She's got his endorsement. So you get, you know, you pick up the other folks, and you sort of need to be catering a little bit to that wing of the party. Remember, as soon as that election's over, they've got to sort of look and say, how do I win a general election? And if Trump is unpopular in the district on the whole, and you've got to beat a sitting member of Congress, it can be an uphill challenge for sure.
Neil, something you mentioned just now struck back to one of our earlier conversations where you mentioned that folks go to media these days for affirmation, not information. And it's a dynamic that I think has, to some degree, hardened the folks on the far left and the far right. And, you know, there's a degree of lack of reflection of the fact that the art of governing is the art of uncomfortable compromise, not the comfort of an uncompromising ideology. That's how you get things done. That's the Amy Klobuchar of the world and others. But the hardening of the, if you will, of the far right and to some degree the far left, and how that plays out in primaries right now, given that dynamic that we've talked about on this show with you. Talk a little bit about whether or not you think that is necessarily healthy for democracy, small d, that dynamic that has emerged and how it plays out in primaries.
Well, I think that politics is a reflection of the people, and we sort of get what we ask for, right? So people vote in primaries, and everybody has the option to do so if you meet the criteria of a voter. But we see that the people who are on the far left or the far right are the people that tend to do that, and their voice carries.
Yep.
You know, when you go and you are nominating someone who is much further to the right than the general electorate in the state or in the congressional district, you know, you gamble with the fact that you're going to lose the election. And it happens all the time. You know, basically, to boil things down, people say, well, I'm going to vote for the person that's a pure conservative or a pure progressive in all aspects, and then they go on to get defeated because the electorate doesn't necessarily reflect that. And so it's a calculated risk. You know, do you want to win with 80% or do you want to lose with 100%? And so a lot of voters don't do it. Do I think it's healthy? No. I think that in our system of government, you know, the argument is good, but in the end, we've got to sort of figure things out and get together. But remember, one person's progress is another person's detrimental legislation that hurts them. So it's not all compromise isn't necessarily good. I always joke around that, you know, if Ken Kale, if the police came into the studio today and they arrested Ken Kale for murder, and of course Ken's a really nice guy, one of the nicest people in New Hampshire, so he's not a murderer, but he hired a lawyer, and they said, well, you know what, for the sake of compromise, Ken, why don't you just plead guilty and serve 10 years? And Ken's going to say, but I didn't do it. But, you know, we want to have compromise. So compromise cannot always be good either. And that's an extreme example. Sorry, Ken.
Yes, it is. It is very extreme.
But, you know, compromise is not always good. And if there's a piece of legislation that's working its way through Congress or through the State House that's really detrimental to your beliefs, values, or potentially your family or your business, you don't want to necessarily see that piece of legislation exist as a law.
Neil, I'll tell you what, it's been a great conversation today. As always, there's so many avenues we could go down, but in the few seconds we have left, I haven't asked you about the bees yet.
My bees got hit by a bear, and
oh, no.
He won, and and so this year I'm without bees because as soon as he hit them, they basically say, we got to take our queen elsewhere. So they hightailed it for some other location. I keep the hive up just in case they come back because they can do that if they think that it's a safe place. But this year, no bees. I got a lot of hummingbirds, though.
Oh, yeah?
And
yeah.
Having fun with those because I got all the hummingbird feeders out. It's really a spectacular hobby to watch those.
People love their hummingbirds, don't they? They really and truly do.
You see these little tiny things, and they go all the way to South America in winter.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, that is really amazing. Neil, thanks so much. As always, we'll have you back soon because there are a lot more things to talk about on the political side, but always love to hear about your exploits on the high seas and your bees. I'm sorry to hear about your bees, but I guess, you know, the bear prevailed.
Bear prevailed.
Yeah. Neil,
thank you.
Thanks so much,
Take care, Neil.
Always appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Take care. Neil Levesque, the executive director of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. We'll take a quick break. Feldis and Kale will continue right after these words. 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, Feldis and Kale. Proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers as we head down the home stretch of another program.
Coming home.
But we want to remind people that the annual League of New Hampshire Craftsmen's Fair is underway through Sunday of this week as we air this program for the first time on August the 10th, 10 to 5 each day at the Mount Sunapee Resort in Newberry. And more information at nhcrafts.org, nhcrafts.org. Always a great time up in the Mount Sunapee area. And, you know, the great part about it, Dan, is you can go there, have a great time. They're having beer and wine this year, as you know, as we heard Miriam Carter say. And you can do your Christmas shopping and get the folks on your list something very unique and very New Hampshire.
No doubt about it, and just a lot of great artists and folks all around New Hampshire that make some amazing pieces of work. You can find pretty much all of it there.
Well, Dan, you're an amazing piece of work as well.
And find a nickel.
We will join.
10 cents, maybe.
We'll see you again next time on our next edition of Feldis and Kale right here on WKXL.